When you choose an operating system and start to develop for it, you're making a home for yourself. What happens when that home goes away, not once, but twice? And what happens when in your new home, your hardware just doesn't want to cooperate? I sit down with Lucas Hartman to talk about his history in computing, his migration to free and open source software, and how his personal history impacted his new project, the MNT Reform, a laptop that not only runs free software, but is also free hardware, user repairable and approachable, here on Libre Lounge. You are listening to Libre Lounge, the podcast about user freedom and all things free, including free and open source software, free culture, free hardware, games, biohacking, and all things related. I'm your host, Serge, he, him pronouns. Now, on with the show.
I started programming as a kid. When I got my first computer, it was Sinclair's ZX81. And it didn't have any software except for the programs printed in a book. And I think in the user manual, like the user manual had an explanation of BASIC and so on. So I was kind of forced to learn a bit of BASIC, or at least to be able to type in programs from a book to make the computer do something. So that was, the payoff, right? And I mean, it was impossible to save the programs to cassette tapes, so that was possible. I don't really remember if I did that from the beginning, probably not, but pretty early, yeah. And I went through many computers, many home computers, pretty late, so there was kind of a time delay between when these systems were actually on the market and like current and when I got them. So because I'm 35, and so it was the late 80s, early 90s when I had like 8-bit computers and 16-bit computers. And then in the mid 90s, when people already had PCs, I still had an Amiga. There was always a bit like of a technology lag between what I got and what was current. But it was kind of okay because I didn't know that there was other stuff already out there. I was living in the countryside, pretty isolated. Yeah, that was just, you know, for me, the computers that I had, and they were super fascinating. Yeah, I was always programming a bit on them. Later I learned, so on the Commodore 64, I learned assembler, and then on the Amiga, I learned C. Then the web appeared. So the internet came to us, I think in 1997 with dial-up. I learned about HTML and then learned some Perl. Like I went with my father to a bookshop and I saw this book about web programming and like CGI programming in Perl, and I wanted that book, and I think my father bought it. And then was the first time I wrote programs that would, you know, make dynamic web applications. And at that time, I was working on a game. So I really wanted to do games, actually. I often forget that. So I did many prototypes of games. I made a real-time strategy game that was never completed. And I had, like, recruited later from the internet two graphics artists, like 3D artists who were from the UK. Like one was from the UK, other was from Croatia. So I had never met them. And the question was, how do we collaborate on this game? And then I wrote like a little forum/file storage thing in Perl. And that was just natural. I wasn't really thinking about, okay, should I, you know, what is the collaboration platform? I was 16 or so. I didn't really think, like, reflect on this. It was just like, okay, this is kind of the natural thing. We need an online thing to share files and graphics and concepts and so on. So those were my first like web applications that were only used by me and our little team then.
So you had your Amiga, and then you had, I guess, a PC that you were connecting to the internet.
Well, no, I was like in the beginning, I was connecting with the Amiga to the internet. Yeah, with the 1200. Yeah. I got a web browser on a CD. You know, I had a CD-ROM, external CD-ROM, and I got some kind of CD with a web browser. I browse and a dial, you know, a TCP/IP stack program called Miami, and I had my Supra Express modem, 33.6K baud, and then I dialed up and went to the web.
You've got this long history, so how did you first encounter free and open source?
Okay, so I think that was actually when I got a PC. I think it was just a borrowed PC at first. I was thinking, it has an ISDN card, so we got ISDN, like an upgrade from the analog phone line to the digital phone system. So it was promised to get a bit more, you know, data rate and two connections, so my parents could still be on the phone while I was on the internet. And but I couldn't use my modem for that anymore, I think. So I got this PC with a ISDN card, and I decided, okay, I want to use this PC as kind of the uplink, and over a serial line, I will still be able to use my Amiga to access the internet. Because it didn't really occur to me that I would use the PC for that, because it was somehow very uninteresting. To do that, I installed FreeBSD on the box. I think it was FreeBSD. And I tried to figure that out, you know, how to do the dial-up thing with ISDN and the IP forwarding and stuff. And it was super alien to me, like this whole Unix stuff and the manual pages and the shells and everything. It was very exciting, but also very frustrating. Yeah, I mean, I remember the C64 experience, like it was a lot because, you know, you have 164, then you have maybe another, or it was a time when people were selling them already used on the classifieds, you know, on a local newspaper. People already got rid of them, and I was like, it was still kind of new to me, so I could grab one more C64 and, like, you know, hundreds of floppy disks from somebody's house, and then it was days of just checking out those disks, you know, like going through each directory, trying each program, you know, no idea what would come up there. I mean, most of it was, of course, pirated games, but also occasional surprises and stuff that I just didn't understand, you know, what the hell is this program? But that was very interesting. And later, the first internet experience was similar, but it was not browsing floppy disks of other people, but it was, you know, other computers over the phone wire, but it was the same kind of scavenging. Yeah, and then it was the same again with FreeBSD and Linux. So I was wondering, okay, what do all the files do in the bin directory? What do all the files do in the etc directory? What is all that stuff? And it was like a lot of stuff compared to what I knew from the Amiga. I mean, the cool thing is that the Amiga was kind of borrowed some ideas from Unix. So the shell wasn't so different, and this kind of concept of commands and libraries and so on. So I knew that already from the Amiga. It was just a bit more cryptic on BSD and Linux. By the way, my first Linux was Zuse, we call it here. It's German distribution. Now I think owned by Novell. Yeah, so that was like my first Linux, like really like it wasn't a box bought from a bookshop, I think. And that was my first Linux experience, I think. I might lie, because there was also some experimental Amiga Linux distribution, but it didn't really work, I think. But and these things, these distributions, I remember installing and going through the installer, and it had, like, you know, it felt like it had millions of options and programs, and I was just completely overwhelmed by, I have no idea what to install, what do I need, you know? So many things, it's in the package manager. What is all that? So yeah, that was kind of a new world to explore. And I can't really get my timeline straight. I think I tried that for a while and then kind of gave up on it, because it was just, you know, I couldn't figure it out. I didn't know what I should use, what was the... It felt like you had to know already. You had to be already a member of a special, very well-informed club of people, and you're supposed to know what to do. So that was kind of like an elite feeling that, you know, also it was like the feeling of I'm not very welcome in this world of, you know, Unix, because somehow I lack the experience. So it was not very welcoming.
So when you got that feeling of not being welcome, how did you respond to that?
Yeah, so I gave up, I think, for a while, because, yeah, I couldn't really get a lot of things done with it. So I went, I think, back to Windows, or I went to Windows, like, I don't remember which version, maybe it was Windows 2000 or so. That was pretty decent, actually. Because all of my friends from school had, you know, Windows, and I wanted to play games with them over the internet. Like, we played StarCraft and all that. I didn't spend any, you know, further thought on open source software and free software and Linux for a while, like for a few years. And then for a brief moment, I was using BOS, like maybe for 1.5 years. I was very into that. I remember it coming up, and then I wrote an email to Be Incorporated in Paris, I think, or just to Be Incorporated, and told them, you know, I am a student, I cannot afford a BOS, but I really would like to program for it. And a few days later, I had a mail, you know, from Paris, like France B division. They just sent me a CD, BOS 4.5 or something. And I installed it, and it was great. You know, it was like, oh my God, this is how it should be. So I had a fantastic 1.5 years or so of like a really fantastic computer experience. So I programmed then a lot of C++ on it. It was super easy.
Yeah, and it had this beautiful model where applications had really well established API interfaces to each other. So programs were much more cooperative than they still are on many platforms. It's like we're still almost catching up.
Yeah, everything felt like, okay, this is really from, you know, cut from the same cloth, so to speak. And there were a lot of very talented people involved in the infrastructure also around it. The community was super welcoming. They had, I don't remember how it was called, but there was some kind of website where you could get the latest B applications. And there was a user group in Germany, also Begeistert, and I went there to Cologne. I still couldn't, you know, I still wasn't 18, so like my father had to drive me there, I remember. And we were sleeping in the youth hostel, meeting other B users from around Europe, I think. And so that was for a while, like a very short while, a very, very nice computing experience again, until it broke apart. Like, because the company went bankrupt again, you know, like, so I had this experience from the Amiga ending, when I just really had a hold on it. And then I had the same experience again with B. So
it's like your home is, you know, is gone each time. And then you have to find a new home. So is that when you went back to the FreeBSD Linux thing and settled there?
No. So what I used Windows for a few years then, because I was kind of like, I gave up on it. You know, I was like, okay, the things that are really nice are not happening in computing. Computing will, you know, the computer is just now some kind of generic, boring tool. I will just use what is mainstream. I did web programming, no more native. I went to university, and I tried 2 times to study computer science, and I dropped out 2 times out of computer science, and then I got accepted into the Berlin University of the Arts, and everybody had a Macintosh, you know, like everybody had an iBook. And I became a Mac user.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Yes, it was art school. You know, I can't show up with my Windows, with a Windows machine in art school. And I was kind of interested also. Like, I was like, Apple started to do really well suddenly again. And they made interesting, like, they had bumped up their product quality significantly, and it their OS X took off, and it was a time of later of Snow Leopard and so on. And I was very into OS X, and it was fun. But I bought, I think, my last MacBook in 2013. So that's 7 years ago. Yeah, I still have it and use it to watch Netflix. because I need DRM for that. Then I got, after there was kind of a peak of peak Apple, let's say, peak Mac OS X or Mac OS 10. I don't know how to call it actually. Things started to go downhill. It was apparent that Apple was focusing on mobile, and that their engineering quality went down, and somehow you were suddenly forced into this whole App Store advertising updates, stuff starts to break, it's inconsistent and so on, and I started to not like it anymore. So, and I was like, this is kind of the people that I then was communicating with more and more were from, had more like a hacker background, and on the Mac I was also more into programming again, also into native programming, and I realized that I should look into open source software again, because I just tried, like, maybe I was bored or frustrated, I don't remember, but I wanted to run Linux on this MacBook, and I thought, how hard could it be, right?
I feel like I'm going to find out the answer is hard.
It was hard, but it was possible. Someone wrote a weird bootloader, and I think called Refind, and you could actually do it. So it was a Retina MacBook Pro 2013, and I was running then Debian on it. That was the time when I started to stay on Linux. It was really not the best experience at first, because there was like a lot of weird driver problems. So, for example, the Wi-Fi didn't work, the audio didn't work. But it was very fast. Suddenly, like, the machine had a lot more performance. You know, I felt like the same machine was much faster with this free operating system than what Apple was delivering for it. But I felt also constrained by weird driver problems, and I thought, I want this, but wouldn't it be great if everything would just work and I would also understand how the machine is built, because I realized how much weird proprietary stuff was going on, you know, during boot, and I realized I don't really understand what this computer is doing. Then that was kind of the start to research into and think about a machine, a portable machine that would have, that I could understand, you know, that where I knew what it was doing when it was booting.
Where everything was, yeah, everything was something that was designed to work with it. It sounds like these other systems that you really liked working with, you know, from the Commodore C64 to the Amiga. Well, you didn't have a B machine, but you know, the BOS and the Mac, these were all systems that, you know, they came from one, you know, one company, one team. And so everything that came out of it was designed to work together, as opposed to that experience that you had with the early Linux system, where, oh, like this driver for this, you know, Wi-Fi card. Oh, I have to, so maybe I have to change the driver, or maybe I have to make my own driver, or maybe I have to change the card, and this and that and the other thing. And so that sounds like that unification and drive for singular experience is a big part of this design decision that you had for the MNT reform.
Yes, that's correct.
So we should talk about what the MNT reform is, which is your complete, not just open source, but completely free hardware with no binary blobs, you know, completely open specs, 3D printable, and I think for me, most exciting is designed to be worked on. So not just, oh, you know, yeah, if you find a company that will build you this case and build you all these parts in this exact configuration, but hey, you can swap out each component.
That's the idea. The idea is that you really own it, you know, and that all the decisions that we make in designing it is, you know, speaking that language that this is really yours. We give it to you. Then it's not ours anymore. Do with it what you want. We will help you doing that. You can ask any question. There is no taboo here, no secret mystery, except maybe in some of the parts that we have to use or that we, you know, that we soldered there. But that can hopefully also be exchanged and, you know, alternatives can be made for it. But another part is also that we ship it with a Linux distribution that where everything works out of the box, you know. So I did like a lot of testing, compiled a lot of software on it. We have a set of kernel patches that also will need to be upstream, but there are other projects that go the way like, okay, we have this cheap hardware, we'll throw it in the market and the community will figure out the software, right? But for this thing, it's important that there is a reference operating system, a reference platform, including applications that is tested and that you can use, like that you can turn it on and you can use these things and it's not an afterthought.
I mean, that's very exciting. And it sounds like, you know, I know we took a long way to get to the M&T reform, but it sounds like these experiences you had of using these very polished systems and then losing your home, like, you know, you'd set up and then it's like, oh, I'm finally home. And then it's like, oh, the company goes out of business. And so now you're stuck again. It has really informed the way you're building this because in many ways, of course, the fact that you're using existing software and leveraging existing free software is going to help you. But also the design and the way you're putting out these designs means that even if you were to go away, that someone else could pick up, you know, could pick up all the pieces and build upon that.
Yeah, so it's designed to outlive us, you know. I hope we won't go away, but should we go away, then we will do anything we can to provide all the information that someone can pick it up and that more people can pick it up and that it can be maybe kind of, you know, contagious. And also this is at the same time a protection from, you know, patent trolls or something. So if somebody should attack the company and we are forced to close it, then the information is already out there and you cannot easily erase it from the internet. So that's why, for example, we already release the sources before we even sell the thing. And we update them as we go because any day someone could sue us or, you know, create a problem for us. But then everything is already out there. So I encourage people to clone the repo also.
So that also means that you can easily have an ecosystem around your platform. That would be very challenging. It's like if I want to build a peripheral for, I don't know, Dell or Apple, like there's a pretty big barrier for me to do that, right?
You need an agreement with Apple to do that, yeah.
But it sounds like since all the specs are out, I or, you know, somebody could just make up a new part, have it printed from one machine, have it printed for 10 or a million.
Yeah.
That's a very exciting, different development style for hardware than we've seen.
Yes, absolutely. I don't know if it how well it will work out for us, but it's an experiment also, right? Mm. And I feel pretty comfortable with this. Much more comfortable than, you know, keeping everything for us, like protecting everything, like it's a big secret and fighting off anyone who wants to copy it or something. This is really, this kind of stuff makes me very tired, you know. I'm really tired about copyright questions and this kind of protection of ideas and so on. It just makes me yawn, you know, like I'm absolutely not interested in that. I want to have progress. I want to have knowledge shared, and I want to have a nice community around it.
So you put out this crowd supply for this project, and as of the time of recording, which is, you know, it's going to be earlier than when you're listening to this, but you've already met your goal. So the thing is coming out for sure.
Yes.
So how long do you think it's going to be before regular backers get a machine in their hands?
They will get it this year, definitely. Like we posted like I think the campaign says December. Yeah, I don't want to overpromise, but I'm very, very positive that this year people will get the thing.
Of course, we're going to have the link to the crowd supply on the show notes, and people can order these laptops, and hopefully by the end of 2020 or 2021, people will have them in their hands. So do you have any thoughts on where you're going to go from here?
Yeah, we have some ideas. I have some ideas. We are with Anna working at the same time on the Reform standalone keyboard. I'm also using a prototype of that for my daily work. So it's basically the same keyboard that is in Reform, just in a special case. And it has a USB-C connector.
It's just funny how many free keyboards there are. In fact, we had, we interviewed Phil Hegelberg maybe 6 months ago, of course, and he built his, and then we also, well, we didn't interview, but there's the famous Model 1. It's funny how many free software people, once they get into hardware, they're like, I have to build my own keyboard.
Sure. Yeah. It's almost like this kind of rite of passage, but yeah, we do it because people were interested in the keyboard, and it's very small. It's very compact. There are not so many slim, slim mechanical keyboards. Most of them have MX or similar big keys. So this is one of the few very compact slim mechanical keyboards. And the thing is, if you use a Reform and you use another computer, you will have the same keyboard. And if you got used to it, it's easier to to change in between them, to switch than if you have a very different layout. This can help with the typing speed a bit. And yeah, so that's one kind of smaller project. We are in talks with different people about replacement or alternative CPU modules for Reform. So that is a very exciting thing. The possibility that you can exchange the main CPU and memory and GPU because they are on a little card in Reform. So there's we're in talks with someone who wants to make FPGA based board, so that could then have a RISC-V soft core or another core, and on another FPGA a gateware implemented graphics card. So that will allow.
So basically, that we could swap out, all of these things that are usually the reasons that these machines go out of date, right? It's like, oh, this machine is too slow for modern stuff, but here we can change the RAM, we can upgrade the CPU, we can upgrade the graphics card, while keeping the same case, or even 3D printing a new case. So that's, that means that ultimately this machine could last for many, many years. And also the fact that you have the ability to not just change the battery, like the way many laptops where you can just swap the battery, but in fact, it's relatively off the shelf battery cells.
Yeah. So you cannot use the cells that go into e-cigarettes or something like the same. They have the same form factor, but they have a different chemistry. So you cannot use standard lithium-ion batteries because those tend to heat up and explode, and they're too dangerous. You have to use the lithium iron phosphate chemistry, and there are several online shops where you can buy them very cheaply. So, for example, here in Europe, I don't know the prices for the US, but here I could buy in the Netherlands from an online shop the replacement batteries, and they would cost me around €2.50 per cell.
And there's 8 cells, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So for under 20,
yeah,
for about €20, you can totally replace your battery.
Yeah.
And I mean, which is also one of those parts that often is the first to go, right?
Yeah.
Because these laptops, you know, that you charge them, discharge them. And then at some point, the thing starts to be, it doesn't hold its charge as well as long and this and that. Yeah. And then, you know, you try to go to the manufacturer's website and buy a new battery, but it's hard to find because they made 50 models of this thing. And then if you want to, you have to remove the keyboard and the motherboard and, and don't touch this piece because it's so super fragile and it makes you afraid to do any kind of maintenance on your machine. So this is exactly the opposite of that, right? This is, you can do it in, in the video you have, it's just a few screws to unscrew the back and then you can basically do it with your hands. Yeah.
Then just unplug them. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's, to me, like, that's a really huge selling point. And even I would say that, you know, you're talking about making the keyboard external. I also can imagine people are going to make other keyboard layouts. Maybe.
Yeah, it already happened, actually.
Hmm. Oh, really? So there's other people making other keyboards for your laptop.
Yeah, so there was someone that contacted me and showed me already like a KiCad 3D render of an ortholinear keyboard he designed. So it wasn't completely polished, but he took my design file and went in there and shifted the keys around and I was like, here, don't you want to make a ortholinear keyboard as well? And I was like, that's very cool. I mean, we won't include it in the campaign now because it makes things too complex, but this is exactly what I want to see as kind of like a third-party add-on or a thing that people could then do. Maybe we will pick it up and sell it, you know?
I don't know if you've read the book Little Brother by Cory Doctorow.
No, I haven't. I know about it, but I haven't read it, no.
It's sort of, I'm going to spoil it only a tiny bit. It's about this young boy. He's 16, 17. He gets wrongly arrested and accused of being a terrorist in the U.S. And the first thing they do is after they arrest him, spoilers, they start messing with his phone and his laptop.
Mm-hmm.
And in response, you know, the whole rest of the book is him essentially learning computer security and privacy and also teaching the audience about these same topics as he's going through his experience. And, this book was written, I think, in like 2004, 2005. And, you know, he mentions things that are fictitious, right? So he uses a Linux distribution called Paranoid Linux. But now... like Tails is essentially Paranoid Linux, right?
True.
Like it, you can kind of swap it in. And in the book, he notices that his laptop doesn't quite fit right anymore. Like they've put in a keylogger, and he opens it up and he sees that. And the only reason he notices that is that when they sealed the laptop back up, it wasn't quite perfect. And I was thinking when I was watching the video of the MNT reform how the back of yours is clear plexiglass.
Yeah.
And it would be really hard to hide something
in a
clear plexiglass laptop, right? Or at least where one side is. And I don't know, I feel like we're in this convergence of, so we finally have reproducible builds, right? With Geeks and the Debian reproducible builds project, we now know, or we can have as much faith as we possibly can that the software we're running is really the software we intend. And with projects like yours, with this laptop, we have assurances that all the drivers are free software, that all the blobs, I think you have one blob that you can't completely replace yet, but for the most part, everything is free, the specs are free, and the, you know, most and all the hardware that is possible to be replaced at this point is free. And it's like we're getting to this place where we can really have a completely 100% free operating system, not just for the conceptual beauty of, oh, isn't this beautiful that it's free, which is great and I'm totally there, but it's also the security model of saying like, yeah, we know what's in this.
Yeah, it's auditable.
There's no surprises. Mm. Yeah, exactly. I think that's a really big component of this. And in your campaign, you say like, oh, well, we don't have a camera and we don't have a microphone.
Correct, yeah.
Right?
That's a psychological issue mostly. Because, you know, people have said, yeah, you can put a switch in there, physical switch, then you could also disconnect it. But then it's also like, okay, did you remember to switch it off? You know, were you imagining things? You know, the idea was just to get rid of it completely because I saw so many people putting tape on their camera and had this feeling that they don't trust the device, you know. So this was a very conscious decision to really remove these things that you don't even need to remember to switch something off. It's just not there.
And of course, if someone really feels strongly about it, they can build a new screen and a case with the microphone and the hardware switch. And,
easy, yeah, sure.
Yeah, I mean, and I think that's the other beautiful part here is that we'll see that maybe actually, you know, maybe people will say, oh, no, I really need the microphone and camera.
Sure, yeah, that can happen.
Maybe it'll just be like, no, I really actually absolutely need that and I can't live without it. And so somebody will make it. And that will be the one that wins, and you'll say like, oh yeah, you know, you'll come back in a year or 2 years, and you'll say, ah, well, it looks like I was wrong. People
sure,
really like
happen,
cameras.
Yeah.
That's okay, right? Like, so I, you know, I think this is really an exciting project. I've pledged a few so that I
thank you
for myself and for my fiance.
Cool.
And you know, because I think it's important for everyone to have. And I also got essentially spare parts so that I can, should anything happen, I can fix it. You know,
yes.
If I did that with I can't really do that with my Dell, right? Like,
yeah,
you know, I can't say like, oh, with the laptop, can you also just send me a box of laptop parts? You know.
Yeah,
I mean they'll. I think they might sell them to me individually. It'll cost me more than the laptop itself.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And but this is really exciting and great. I really appreciate you coming on. Is there anything that you want to talk about that we haven't maybe covered?
Also, one thing is that might be interesting for some. So the first customer of the beta, there are a few beta versions of Reform that we are building right now and shipping very, very soon now. I think 8 people in total. And one of them, the first who bought it was Gnode Labs. And they work on an alternative operating system called Gnode that works very differently from what we're used to. But it's more like a construction kit for operating systems. And this will run natively on Reform.
Oh, cool.
And then you can kind of piece together parts of Linux and BSD on top of it. It's more like a interactive hypervisor kind of thing. It's really crazy.
That sounds cool.
Yeah. I got a demo of it and I was pretty excited about it. The other thing is that the FPGA-based CPU card that I was talking about will be very interesting because this will allow you to... I mean, it's more a conceptual thing. It won't be super fast, you know. I hope it will be... It should be fast enough to use, for example, a terminal to do things in the cloud or something. To do email and so on. But this will have all the CPU and the graphics defined in software because it's FPGA based. So that will be kind of the prototype of what can be in the future, like where you can download for your chip not only the documentation, but the source code of the hardware, you know, the source code of the chip's logic gates. So that would be pretty interesting, I think.
That would be interesting, and that would allow for iteration of hardware in a way that we really haven't seen, because most of us don't have FPGA hardware.
Yeah, and Bunny is doing, like Bunny of Novena fame, is doing a little thing that I also, like, I kind of bumped into him, was introduced to him in end of last year in CCC Congress, which was a big honor for me. He had a prototype of his new device called the BeTrusted, and that was also very very neat idea of having a FPGA-based handheld computer for security purposes, where you could validate, you know, like kind of as reproducible hardware into the gate level. You can validate that nobody has tampered with your device on that level. So I think, yeah, there will be quite some more dimensions of this to come. Like reform is at the current iteration went very far, opening up the input devices and opening up the most of the motherboard and all of the case design and so on. So we kind of have now a platform for further experimentation and to take this concept further. So this is not the end of the line, you know, but I thought it was really time to get things rolling.
Is really exciting. I mean, I think that there's this convergence, as you've said, of getting, you know, free hardware, these looking at this Geode OS, it's microkernel capabilities based. You know, mm-hmm. It's all the things that we've discussed on the show before, you know, FPGAs, which, you know, software-defined, we haven't really discussed software-defined radio and software-defined digital signal processing, but that's such an exciting place for us to go with these operating systems. So this is amazing. I really hope that you'll come back, you know, once things are launched more fully and be able to tell us what's going on and what's new from there. So thank you, Lucas. It's been really amazing having you on.
Thanks for having me. See you here next time.
Libre Lounge is hosted and produced by Sergio Klasky. Connect with the Libre Lounge community by joining our IRC channel at #LibreLounge on Freenode, following us on the Fediverse at LibreLounge at floth.social, emailing us at podcast@LibreLounge.org, or following us on Twitter at LibreLounge. Our theme song is Jazzy Sax Guitar and Organ at the Club by Admiral Bob. This episode is released under the Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike 4.0 International License. See you next time!